Welcome, everyone. Great to have you all here. Great to see you all. I am Cortland Dahl. I think I've probably either met or at least been on a session with most of you, but if you don't know me, I'm one of the Terragar instructors and I lead these sessions. I know many new people have joined the this program, the Vajrayana Online, just in the past month. So my guessing is there's some of you who might be attending one of these sessions for the first time. And if so, welcome. Great to have you here. Just out of curiosity, actually, maybe we could get a show of hands. If you're unfamiliar with Zoom, on the bottom navigation of Zoom, there's a button that says Reactions, and you can raise your hand. How many of you are new to Vajrayana Online in the last month? I'm just curious how many of you are just joining. Great. Welcome. Looks like you're all familiar with how to raise your hands. Okay, that's great to see. So you can lower your hands and just wanted to get a sense of who's on with us. So in these sessions, they're called Dharma Geek sessions. Those of you who've been along for the ride for a while now have heard me say this before. Frankly, I feel kind of ambivalent about that we call these Dharma Geek sessions because they are kind of geeky. Hopefully we get into some of the fine points and the nuance of the teachings and the practice and the tradition. But my interest has always been in experience and in practice. And although I've done a lot of work as a translator and as a scholar in this tradition, what really gets me out of bed is the practice tradition. It's really how we can actually apply these teachings to our own inner experience. So it's not just theory and talking about philosophy or anything like that in these Dharma Geek sessions. It really hopefully is getting into some of the really most critical, important points for practice. And we can use some of the terminology, some of the key ideas and really unpacking those, hopefully at a deep level, as a way to kind of open doors into our own mind and our own inner experience. So that's kind of the approach that I like to think we take in these sessions. So kind of depending where we are in the course, sometimes that might mean going very deeply into the root verses. So we've done that in some cases where we really just go word by word and line by line. And again, really trying to get at the most important experiential points of the tradition and how the words and the images and the phrases that are chosen can help unlock that inner experience for us. And in some cases, and I think what we'll do today is zooming out a bit and picking, one or two key points from the topic. And of course, here we're just beginning this year-long transmission of the Ganges Mahamudra text and the Mahamudra tradition more broadly. So here we'll kind of just zoom out and pick a really important idea. So the one that I thought we would talk about today is one of the most important aspects of the entire Mahamudra tradition, which is what we call pointing out instructions. And there's a very a way that this is phrased in Tibetan. There's a word in Tibetan that is ngotr, and it's basically the Tibetan what we translate as pointing out instruction, or sometimes as the introduction to the nature of mind. So I thought we actually could go into that exact term and what pointing out instructions, what the role the pointing out instructions play in this tradition, and just kind of what we can glean from the words themselves. And I can share a little bit about why this is so important and how it's used in the tradition. So that's what we're going to be focused on here. Usually I like to start with a little bit of practice just to get us all in the space of direct experience. And then we dive in and we'll talk about the main point, which of course, as I just said, is this idea of pointing out instructions. And then hopefully there'll be some time at the end for a little discussion and Q&A. So let's go ahead and start with a few moments of practice. You can go ahead and settle in, get comfortable. I like to start with just a very simple process of bringing myself fully into the space of practice by starting with the body and posture. So you can check in with your posture. The most important key points are to be upright and also relaxed and at ease. So bring awareness into your body and just see if you can find that balance between being both alert, wakeful, and yet not holding too tightly, just allowing, letting go, letting be. Notice the movement of your breath. Notice your connection with the earth, perhaps your feet on the floor. Your hands resting on your lap, on your thighs. And next, bringing your heart into the practice by reflecting on your motivation. And here we can do this in a kind of with a unique nature of mind Mahamudra twist by setting a motivation that through our practice together, through our path and our own journey, we can help not only ourselves, but all beings recognize the boundless, open clarity of pure awareness, to help all beings recognize the true nature of their own mind. So use whatever phrases or images work for you, but let's just connect with that open-hearted motivation of bodhicitta. And finally, we can bring our mind into the space of practice by letting go of all the busy doing energy, even the doing energy and mental effort of meditation, and just let go and rest your mind naturally. You don't need to focus on anything. You don't need to concentrate. Allow yourself to shift from a state of doing to one of simply being. If you can remain radically open to whatever you are experiencing in this moment, it doesn't matter if your mind is busy or calm. It doesn't matter if your body is relaxed or tense. It doesn't matter if your environment is calm and peaceful or noisy and chaotic. Awareness can accommodate everything. So just rest in open, effortless awareness. Let everything be as it is. And you can allow your senses to remain open. You're hearing my voice, hearing other sounds in the world around you. all the sensations within your body. World of color and shape, even if your eyes are closed, you could notice the play of light on your eyelids. Or if your eyes are open, notice all of the rich world of color around you. Oh, this is the most ordinary thing in the world. We're just tuning to what is happening in this moment. Nothing special, no altered state of consciousness needs to happen. Just being fully in this moment. Okay, you can open your eyes if they've been closed. Perhaps wiggle your fingers and toes a little bit. Stay connected to your body. One of the beautiful things about this nature of mind tradition, like Mahamudra and Dzogchen, which is one of the other nature of mind traditions in Tibetan Buddhism, is that meditation isn't just what happens when your body is still and you light your incense and close the shades and everything's perfect and you're sitting perfectly still and then you meditate. Meditation is a way of being. So even right now, as you're listening to me, if you're just connected to awareness, if you stay connected and grounded in awareness and you do whatever you're doing right now, listening to me, or as we get up later in our day and you're walking or you're talking to somebody or you're doing some kind of work or some chore around your house, anything and everything can be meditation. That idea that meditation isn't so much about the posture, although that can help, and it's more about the quality of presence we bring into all of the different things we do in life. That idea is very much rooted in these Mahamudra teachings. So Mingyur Rinpoche, for those of you who are students of Rinpoche or have done The Joy of Living or other teachings with him, he always talks about this idea of any time and anywhere. And that, in a way, is really the heart, one of the key points of Mahamudra is that here we're not trying to create an altered state of consciousness. And the reason for that is because our own nature, our Buddha nature, is already whole and pure and complete. So because who we are in our very essence, at our very core, is already perfect, we don't need to change anything. We don't need to kind of reach some, plane of consciousness that we've never experienced before. Rather, we need to learn to explore and to recognize what has been with us all along. So that's kind of the heart of this whole tradition. So if you look at the whole sweeping scope of Buddhist thought and practice, going from the very foundational teachings of the Four Noble Truths all the way up to these teachings on Mahamudra, a lot of those steps along the way are or critically involve some kind of activity. We're doing something with our mind. We're doing something with our experience. So we bring awareness to the breath so we can calm and stabilize the mind. Perhaps we do some analytical meditation so we can answer some question or gain some new insight that we didn't have before. Or we cultivate compassion or patience or any number of other qualities. And there's all these practices. There's so many things to visualize. There's so many things to learn about. There's so many things to contemplate. When we get to Mahamudra, which is the final step of that whole process, these are considered the highest, the most profound, the most transformative, the most precious teachings of the entire path. It's almost as though we get to just drop that whole effort and let go of that whole process of moving towards something. And instead, it's simply a process of recognizing what's already here. So you can see in this that the whole process, the entire path of Mahamudra is really goes back to the teachings on Buddha nature. We're kind of taking that idea of Buddha nature, this idea that who we are at our core is already perfect and whole and complete. And Mahamudra is simply adding to that a really powerful process whereby we can experience that Buddha nature. And what sets Mahamudra and its companion Dzogchen apart from other approaches is that although Buddha nature is found in many other strands of Buddhism, oftentimes the way we work with that is almost through a conceptual process. You can understand the idea of Buddha nature, and you do all these practices of, you know, shamatha and vipassana, or calming the mind and gaining insight, other practices where you might visualize or contemplate different things, but it's still almost as though you have to work towards Buddha nature. It's still a goal. It's something we're going to get to. So in the early teachings on Buddha nature is almost framed as a seed. It's a potential that is not yet actualized. So you need to surround that seed with the right conditions. There needs to be soil, and there needs to be warmth, and there needs to be moisture, and there needs to be nutrients. And if you surround that seed with all of those conditions, eventually it's going to sprout and you'll have, you know, the fruition of what that, the potential of that seed. So in traditional terms, in the seed form, it's Buddha nature. And in its fully ripened potential, it's the kayas. It's the Dharmakaya, the Sambhogakaya, and the Nirmanakaya. Those are simply Sanskrit terms, wonky terms for the enlightened state, the state of full and complete Buddhahood or awakening. So there's that potential, but it's not yet fully actualized. That's kind of the most common way that Buddha nature is presented. But when you get to Mahamudra, and again, the same is true in Dzogchen, which, as I said, is one of the other nature of mind traditions, that Buddha nature is not merely a potential. It's not something that's there in a latent form, but we need to somehow help to sprout and to germinate it, to mature. It's actually fully present in its fully expressed form. And the only challenge is that we don't recognize it. So it's not as though it's not fully actualized or fully manifest. It's there, but we simply don't know how to see it. We haven't learned to get in touch with it. So that's the unique take on Buddha nature that you find in these nature of mind traditions. So I can say from my own experience that when I first encountered these teachings, I had been practicing, let's see, I had probably been practicing about 8 years, maybe, when I first received nature of mind teachings. And I remember when I first received pointing out instructions, and I'll talk a little bit more about what that means in a few minutes, it was such a relief because although I didn't really think of it this way, I was putting so much energy into this kind of forward moving aspect of practice. It always felt like, yes, my practice, you know, it's helpful, it's calming, it's certainly inspiring, but there was always this sense of I'm going towards something. Someday I'm going to have that huge insight. Someday I'll have this awakening thing that I'm reading about, or someday maybe my mind will finally settle down, or I'll have enough compassion or whatever. But there was always this sense of the future, and it mirrored what I think most of us have just in our lives generally, not necessarily our meditation, but we bring it into our meditation. And that is, simply put, an addiction to the future. We have a mindset and a whole culture and even our biological programming that basically is creating this incredibly strong tendency to always be projecting forward. And the unfortunate consequence of that, there's lots of positive things about that. It allows us to do all sorts of things like planning and inventing things and creating things and improving things. All of the quote unquote progress of human civilization is based on that capacity we have. So it's good in many ways. The shadow side to that is it creates this almost unconscious sense that who we are in this moment is not enough. What we have right now, who we are right now, could always be better. And it becomes an addiction to the final fulfillment, who we would like to be, or what we would like society to be, or what we would like our job to be, or what we would like our relationships to be, is almost, because of this tendency, it's always out there. It's always in the future. So Mahamudra is just completely dismantling that unconscious belief, and just again and again and again pointing us back to what is here now, and just reminding us that yes, there might be things that we're moving towards, but when it comes to the spiritual path, the path of awakening, the process of meditation, it is fundamentally a process of waking up to who we are, not to who we would like to be or who we hope to be. And that's, again, really the essence of Mahamudra. So we could talk a lot about what Mahamudra means, even the term. We're going to get into that for those of you who continue on with the immersion course, and we'll hear a little bit about it. And you might have already learned a little bit about it in the essence course that we're with right now. But basically, if you kind of let go of the etymology of the actual word, Mahamudra is simply put just a way of referring to the nature of our own consciousness. It's just saying that emptiness and clarity, which is to say the knowing quality of mind, that these are aspects of our being. And they're much more fundamental to who we are than all of the things we normally equate our sense of self with. So normally, we equate our sense of self with our personal history. We equate ourselves with the roles we play. We equate our sense of self and our identity with our relationships or our emotional habits. But if you really examine all of that, what you'll find is that all of those things, although they're certainly part of who we are, they're changing. All of those things are conditioned. Our habits change, our relationships change, our personal history changes, our job change, our memory changes. All of these things are changing and shifting and moving. And in that sense, although they're certainly an important part of our experience, and they certainly shape how we see ourselves and how we see the world, they're not core and essential to who we are because they're not stable. And this gets into some Buddhist philosophical points, which is how you determine what something truly is. And there's this idea, there's actually a term, tsenyi in Tibetan, which means the defining characteristics of something. Things, including us, all have many different qualities. And some of those are qualities that are not enduring or essential, meaning that they're not always present. So I always use the example from when I was younger and when I first started meditating that I viewed myself as being an anxious person. Like I was just anxious. That's kind of who I am. But if I really would have looked closely back in those early days as a meditator, I would have seen that actually I'm not always anxious. There's some times where I'm not anxious at all. And this is exactly what's meant by this term tenyi, or defining characteristics. It's not that anxiety was just not important at all to my experience, but it wasn't essential to who I was because it was not always there. Something that is essential means that it's always there. So wetness, you know, or moisture is an essential characteristic of water. If it's water, if it's in that liquid form, it's always going to be wet. That's an essential form. But is water always clear? Is it always red? Is it always salty? No, it can be. Sometimes it can't be. Those are essentially conditioned qualities that will change. So here, when we talk about these qualities of emptiness, for example, kind of the ungraspable openness of awareness, that is always there. No matter how many times you look at your own mind and your own inner experience, if you know how to look, you can always find that sense of openness, that sense of spaciousness, that ungraspable quality of our experience. So from that point of view, you can say it's an essential quality because, again, if you know how to look, you can always see it there. It's never not there. It's not to say we always see it. It's not to say we are always in touch with it, but it's always there for us to see if we, again, if we know how to look. So in the path of Mahamudra, it's really how do we let go of our fixation on all of these things that are more temporary and not really core to who we are, and instead orient ourselves to what is essential for our being, what is truly who we are, what is the core of who we are. And again, that is pure awareness from the point of view of these traditions, the empty clarity of consciousness itself. And again, the point isn't to believe this. This is not a belief system that we adopt. The whole point is, how do we actually experience this for ourselves? So that brings us to the main topic I wanted to talk about today, which is this idea of pointing out instructions. So if you practice Mahamudra and you study Mahamudra, a term you're going to hear again and again is recognition. Recognition is simply what I just mentioned a moment ago. It's how we actually see and experience Buddha nature for ourselves. So when we directly experience that, which is not to say we understand theoretically, but we actually have a glimpse of that in our own inner experience, then we, it's said that we have recognized nature of mind. We have recognized our own Buddha nature, so to speak. So the Tibetan word for this is very linked to the idea of pointing out. And I'll get into the kind of the nuance of those words in just a moment. But the question then, if we talk about the core of this whole process being to recognize our own Buddha nature, then the question is, well, how? What is the most expedient way that we can move from simply understanding that this Buddha nature is present to actually experiencing that for ourselves? So it's not somebody else's reality, somebody else's idea, somebody else's experience, but it's our own. It's actually part of our own lived, felt experience. Well, in this sense, the process that we find in Mahamudra is really not very different than how we learn generally, which is a lot of what we learn is simply through social relationships. A lot of the most important things that we learn over the course of our lives, we learn because there's somebody else who has role modeled that for us. And whether they taught us directly or we simply learned by being around them and observing them, it's through our relationships that we oftentimes have the most important transformative learning. So you could come up with many, many examples of this. If you want to learn to play an instrument, you would never go to somebody who had read a million books about playing the piano, but couldn't actually play. If you wanted to be a, you know, a star tennis player, we just had the US Open here in the US, and my mom's a huge tennis fan. So I was hearing all about Coco Gauff, you know, who won this young woman who won the US Open here. So I've been hearing about that, you know, this just remarkable young woman, right? She learned, she has coaches. She obviously has been totally devoted to this. You know, somebody like her, you would never go to somebody who had never picked up a racket, no matter how much they could tell you about the theory of tennis. You would never talk to somebody who couldn't throw the ball up in the air and show you how to make a serve or how to hold the racket and all the little experiential nuances of that tradition. You want somebody who has been there. In fact, there was somebody in the US Open, I can't remember, I think it might have been, yeah, I think it was, actually, I don't even remember. But anyways, it doesn't matter. One of the players, I think one of the ones who actually won the US Open this year or was in the finals, his coach had actually won the finals also. So, I mean, there you have it, like a perfect example. And that's the ideal. Like, you want somebody who has been there. You want somebody who knows it intimately. So from the point of view of meditation, this is the importance of finding a teacher. This is, you know, that it's not to worship the guru because the guru needs this. It's because if we want to wake up, if we want to recognize this empty clarity of our own true nature, we want somebody who's walked the path. We want somebody who's been all through the ups and downs and can actually help us from their own personal experience, can guide us along that same journey. So part of it is, again, it's just using that same social learning process that we use in so many other different areas. And again, you could think about your life and what matters to you, and you'll almost certainly find many examples where you learned through having a role model or having somebody to guide you who had been through something themselves. It's just simply how we are as human beings. We are social creatures. Our brains are wired to learn in this way. So there's a very unique way that in the Mahamudra tradition, that social learning, that social dynamic that helps us to learn is used, and it's through this idea of pointing out instructions. The idea is simply put that we, once we form a relationship with the teacher, and by forming a relationship, I don't mean like you have to be going out to dinner, once a month or something like that. I mean, simply that you've recognized that there's somebody you want to learn from, and the opportunity is there to actually learn from that person. That's the relationship that matters. It could be an online relationship. It could be that, as we have in Tergar, you go to an online retreat, or you connect that way. And in fact, although Zoom and this technology is certainly not traditional, that way of connecting very much is traditional, in the sense that you have teachers that became enlightened through connecting with other teachers simply through reading books, which again you could view as a form of technology, right? A book is, we don't think of it as technology because it's just been part of our lives and it's not a new development. But at one point, the printing press was cutting edge technology. And books, believe it or not, were as controversial as, things like the internet and learning through apps are now. It was a new thing at one point. So I'm simply making the point that the way we can connect and learn from each other can take many different forms. And we human beings have always used whatever technology we've had at our disposal to get to use that, to engage in that kind of learning. So however we might form that kind of relationship, the teacher then can slowly guide us along the path and eventually can help us to experience directly our own true nature. So pointing out instructions are when we are given that kind of experiential guidance. You might imagine, if you haven't received these instructions, almost like somebody's giving you a guided meditation and they're just taking you on an experiential trip through your own consciousness. They're helping you to see, amongst all the many different things that are going on in any present moment, helping to orient to these very subtle qualities of consciousness that usually are just simply difficult to see if we don't have somebody who knows what to look for. So it's almost like, going into a huge, busy, crowded mall, say, and you need to find a very specific item. But if you don't know what that item looks like, you don't know what store to go into to find it, you could stumble around for a year looking around, like hoping you might find it. And even if you did find it, you probably wouldn't be very confident that you even found the right thing. But if you had somebody who could guide you step by step and say, okay, go over here, look on that aisle, go down aisle 5, look at the left, you'll see a whole bunch of things, and there's something in the bottom, it's a little red and it's square, and they can point you exactly to it. And then you can hold it up and say, hey, I've got this thing, this is what it is. And they'd say, yep, that's it. That's basically what a teacher is doing when they give you pointing out instructions. So you can contrast that with another process that you also find in Buddhism and certainly other areas of life, where there's guidance like that, but it's more theoretical. You might learn all the theory about the mall and all the theory and descriptions about what to look for, but it's different than having somebody actually guide you step by step, who can actually say, like, okay, you're at the front door of the mall, pull that open, go inside. Okay, now where are you? What do you see? Okay, you're at the kiosk, take a left, go over here. And they're literally, kind of knowing what you're experiencing, guiding you through the process, rather than just having all the theories of that. So the term for that in Tibetan, I've mentioned, is I've been using the term pointing out instruction. I mentioned it's also sometimes called an introduction. And it's called introduction. Actually, that's a very literal term, because this is the same word you would use in Tibetan if you were introducing two people. So you have in Tibetan, the term is ngotru. Literally, if I just unpack that word literally, the first part of that, ngo, is face. And tru means to connect. So it's almost like you're connecting somebody face to face. So if you introduce two people, you're connecting them face to face. They're meeting face to face. And that's basically exactly what that term means in this context. So again, it's a very ordinary term. Like you would just say, this person introduced me to another person. Here, what is it that we're coming face to face with? It's our own Buddha nature. So the ngo here is our own face, our own true face, our own original face, which is to say our own true nature. So in Zen Buddhism, you know, they ask this, like, what was your face before you were born or things like that. You have a similar thing in Tibetan Buddhism, that this idea that, like, who we truly are and the face as being like how you recognize that. So the analogy here is in the same way that we recognize people by recognizing their faces. In fact, there's a part of the brain that is very specifically tasked with recognizing faces. There's like literally a part of the brain that is just the face recognizer, actually. So it's very much like that's how we identify people, right? It's like we look at their face. You know, you don't look at their hands, you don't look at their feet, you look at their face, and that's how we recognize people. So here it's kind of taking that same idea, and we're just recognizing the quote unquote face of our true nature. Like what is that essential defining characteristic by which we could recognize who we truly are? So the teacher then, again, if we play this out, just like a teacher would introduce us, somebody might introduce us to somebody else. A teacher here is the one who skillfully guides us through the experience so that we can recognize and come face to face with our own Buddha nature, which is to say the empty, radiant, clear nature of pure awareness itself. So there's that one term, which is to point out, which is to say to introduce. And then there's the second word that I mentioned earlier, which is to recognize. So there's something that the teacher's doing, and that's the ngotru, that's the pointing out or the introduction part. And then there's something that happens with us, ideally, which is on the basis of that, we then recognize. So the term for this one is, the first same part, ngo, but it's she. So instead of ngotru, it's ngo she. And she means simply to know. So the teacher puts us into face-to-face contact with our true nature, and then we know the face. So if we know or we see, we understand, then we have recognized that true nature. So those two terms together are kind of working together. We need the introduction from a skilled guide. And then ideally, if we've practiced and we've set the right inner context, we have devotion, we have compassion, we've tilled the soil of the mind, so we're ready to be able to receive those instructions, meaning we're a receptive, fit vessel for those pointing out instructions. Then when the teacher guides us through that process, we actually can see that for ourselves. In other words, we know what is being pointed out to us. We understand experientially and can recognize that for ourselves. So all of the path in Buddhism, if you lay out all the different stages and steps, the different instructions, it's really complicated. There are many philosophies. There's many different approaches to meditation, you know, all the different things to work through in the mind and experience. It's quite a complicated, laborious process. But when we get here, actually, it's incredibly simple. It all comes down to this one single point. We recognize our true nature. And then all that the path is, the only thing to do is simply to come back to that again and again and again. Because at the beginning, we recognize it, and it might be just for a moment or a few moments. And then our habitual mind kicks in and monkey mind starts commenting. The storyline starts playing again. We get distracted and it's lost. And that's natural. It's a fleeting moment. We recognize it for a moment and then we lose it. And again, that's the most normal thing in the world, simply because of all of the habits and mental conditioning we have. So then we just go back to that. We practice more. We receive more pointing out instructions. We learn to recognize that. Maybe at first it happens in a retreat, or it happens when you're reading a poem by Milarepa or some other really, you know, conducive environment to having that recognition. And then you go home and you're at work, or you're, you know, with your friends and family, and it's hard. It's not easy to recognize it. Why? Simply because in those circumstances, we are surrounded with all of the habitual all the habitual conditions, or all the conditions, I should say, that are triggering our old habits. So that's why it's hard to recognize. But over time, we can learn to recognize on the cushion when we're meditating. We go and we do more retreats, or we take more courses, and we get a little bit more familiar with it. And then slowly we can bring it out of those in those circumstances. And we can have a glimpse when we're with our friends and family. We can have a glimpse when we're at work. We can have a glimpse when we're in some other, you know, common situation where we have a lot of habits. And eventually, if we stick with that, we nurture that moment of recognition. It slowly gets longer and more stable. And eventually, the momentum begins to shift. The beginning, our habit energy is stronger, and it's almost like that glimpse is powerless just because the habits on the other side are so strong. But over time, that diminishes, and the strength of the recognition increases, and then it's almost as though the momentum goes the other way. It's almost like the world begins to wake us up, and all those conditions begin to wake us up rather than putting us to sleep and taking us away. The critical thing, though, is that we are not nurturing nature of mind. We're not nurturing our Buddha nature in this case. What we're nurturing is our recognition, because Buddha nature is always there, right? We're not going to make that any better. It doesn't need to be nurtured. It's always present. It's always perfect. It's just a question of whether or not we're in touch with that. So again, the critical piece of this is having the skilled guide, and then having all of the conditions that are going to support that process of growing more and more familiar with this. So in any case, this is all to say that at the end of the day, the process really becomes quite simple. This is definitely not easy, and we shouldn't mistake simple for easy, but we can let go of a lot of the complicated, you know, maneuvering of our practice. And it really just comes down to how can we support ourselves and create all the right conditions to facilitate just coming back to that recognition of nature of mind again and again and again. So in the rest of this essence course, we're going to continue just to explore kind of the broad sweeping strokes of this tradition. And then in the immersion course, we're going to get a kind of a very in-depth step-by-step view of how this is presented in this very important, beautiful poem that was written down centuries ago based on basically a song that was sung by one of the great masters of the tradition. And for those of you who don't do the Ganges Mahamudra course, we're going to have a Nectar of the Path course as well, where I think that is equally going to really focus on all those supportive conditions that help us create the right inner circumstances for this process of pointing out and recognition to take place. So why don't we pause here? We've got about 15 minutes left, and I would love to just open it up for any discussion. Anything, any questions you have, you can either put something in the chat. I see Lisa, you have your hand up. So I'll let you turn the mute function off. So you can either put a question or a comment in the chat, or you can raise your hand and we will do it that way. So Lisa, let me just change the settings here. There we go. You should be able to unmute yourself, Lisa. Can you try now? There we go.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. Okay. Oh, this is a really interesting discussion. I appreciate this. Just thinking about what you said, that whole face-to-face idea, and I thought about that, and I said, for myself, what seems to work and what I wanted to share is heart to heart. Because if I see my daughter, who has half of my heart, in an airport, what moves me towards her is my heart, not so much my face. And for myself, I think this is something that I can think about during the day, is how am I connecting with my heart? How does my heart feel right now? And coming back to my heart, that seems to, and that was the first words I heard from Rinpoche, very first words was, "Everything we've ever wanted is right here in this present moment of awareness." I heard that, and it was the heart that heard, "I'm finally home." So just some offerings there this morning.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you, Lisa.
You're welcome.
B.
I'm one of those people who came from the very theoretical tradition. So I've started listening to Mingyur Rinpoche's teaching since 3 years ago. And for the past few months, I have the opportunity to listen to Songyi Rinpoche's teaching. And I finally kind of drilled out, kind of understand what the process is. But I'm not convinced. And the reason I'm not convinced is that, well, at least in a theoretical tradition, it is said that emptiness is a hidden object, a slightly hidden object, of the three objects. So it is not the kind of thing. So being a slightly hidden object, it is something that you come to understand through a process of analysis. And so it is safe to say that non-conceptually, well, speaking for myself, I have not seen emptiness non-conceptually. I only have conceptual understanding of emptiness. So if I can somehow unlearn what I learned before, and I would not recognize that it is emptiness if it is staring it in my face. So, in terms of trying to see the emptiness of the mind, actually, a whole big process is being able to see the mind itself, which in itself is difficult because mind is a subtle phenomena. But if I were to take a more obvious object, say like an apple, so I ask myself, if I look and look at the apple, I put the apple in front of me, I meditate on it and I look at it, would I be able to one day go, aha, that's emptiness of apple without any other instruction by simply just me looking at it? So I really would like to understand and to have the conviction. Because I do like the meditation, Yeah, so.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and there, this is a huge discussion, and this is, one of the main point. I mean, one of the reasons why this particular tradition is held to be more direct than other approaches, even specifically when it comes to just realizing, for example, the nature of emptiness, just as an example, is precisely kind of due to the point that you're talking about of like the hidden object, because it's true. When it comes to the emptiness of the apple, like you can only get at that through inference, and it would be a very long analytical process. I mean, at some point, obviously, it has to be a kind of a direct, cognition, like at some point. But the question is, how do you get there? Like, can you get there just through sort of just staring at the apple? Are you going to eventually see that it's empty, or do you have to really go through some more analytical process? And even in the Mahamudra tradition, and in the Kagyu lineage more generally, which is the lineage these teachings are coming from, when it comes to external objects, I think they would agree with that actually you do need to go through that kind of very rigorous analytical process in order to realize the emptiness of objects and almost all experiences. The one exception to that, and what sets this tradition apart, is that consciousness itself is not a hidden object from this point of view. So the empty, not just the empty quality, that we have direct access to the empty quality of awareness in a way that we don't, for example, with an apple or any other kind of physical object. So because of that, like there's a the process to which we can get to that direct realization is quicker than if we were to go through all the more inferential approach that we would have to take with any external object. But I think more than anything else, I would say, because I too had done a lot of study and, I'd done all this translation of these that kind of the philosophical texts. And, when I started studying this, at the end of the day, I think that the approach to take is just look, like you don't, you need to have enough openness that you're willing to experiment and try. And then ultimately, it's what do you actually find in your own experience? Like actually do the instructions as they're taught. And it's true that the path that you're talking about, which you also find in the Kagyu lineage, it's just one path to awakening. And this is just a different process. The thing is, you're going to find with each path, it's going to talk about the merits of that path. Like, of course, you wouldn't say, hey, here's this great path, but it's the third best one. And I'll tell you why. I mean, no, like each path is going to sort of talk about the inherent logic of that path, right? And that's even within the Kagyu lineage, if you study the development stage, it's like, oh, this is the most amazing thing, and why you have to do it this way and this way and this way. That's just sort of like the rhetoric of the paths. So, I mean, to really get into the subtleties of this, I think we could spend a week talking about some of the more subtle aspects of this. But if you're coming from that more philosophical point of view, I think that you hear a lot about this in the tradition that. It one of the it, that actually it's one of the most challenging things to come to Mahamudra or to Dzogchen with a heavy philosophical training, because we're basically just used to processing the path through that kind of inferential cognitive way, and it becomes almost a mental habit. Like the story that Mingyur Rinpoche tells was of his teacher Salje Rinpoche, and you may have heard this story be, but he tells about the story about how Salje Rinpoche was like a great scholar when he went and did three-year retreat. And he had all, he knew all the theories, and he had studied all of the different traditions. And he was actually getting pointing out instructions. And, basically he had like the inferential process down, and he could say that. And his teacher was just saying, no, like everything he was doing everything right from the point of view of that approach. But his teacher was saying, no, that's not it. No, that's not it. No, that's not it. And it was because he was just still kind of answering from the point of view of concept rather than from his own direct experience. And it wasn't until the teacher just basically had cut through every single possible thing he could get and then was just like, that's it right there, that he finally was able to see something. So I realize that the reality of what I'm saying to you right now is probably going to be completely unsatisfying to the conceptual mind. And I think this is the challenge of making the transition from the more philosophical, inferential approach to the more direct experiential approach of Mahamudra and Dzogchen, is at some point you have to be willing to just let go of the conceptual process and begin the experiential process and just trust that and be open enough to just go that route and see what happens. And when the conceptual mind jumps in, just recognize that that's just conceptual monkey mind. That's basically like monkey mind trained to talk like a philosopher, basically. And so you have to, like, just from the point of view of Mahamudra, treat that like that's just thought activity. It's really wonderful dharmic thought activity, but it's just thought activity. Like doubt is just a version of monkey mind. The philosophical inferential process is just super smart Buddhist monkey mind, but it's monkey mind. So that's the process. It's just relate rather than using the monkey mind to do that, which is there's a path in which we do that. It's almost just saying, okay, like that's not this path. You kind of can't do both at the same time, I think is what I'm saying. You have to at a certain point say, okay, I'm going to go the experiential route. I'm going to explore this. And then it's the certainty that you're looking for is not the same inferential certainty. It's an experiential certainty. And you kind of can't get there through that same route that the philosophical approach is trying to do. So the monkey mind part of you right now, as you're listening, because I've been through this, is going to be completely unsatisfied by that. But hopefully the experiential part will start to wake up and say, okay, I'm willing to give that a try and go that route. And then, again, it's not a belief system. Try it and see what happens, I guess,
So
that's the.
basically, conceptually, I know what emptiness look like, but not conceptually, directly, I don't. So basically, I'm just trusting the process that when I get there, I will know.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that the thing that can help In this case, and it's not, we're not strong culturally in the 21st century with this, but I think for me, what I saw is like trying to reason my way into faith is at a certain or into to confidence wasn't really working for me. But at the end of the day, I thought this worked for Milarepa. Like nobody doubts that this worked out for Milarepa, right? Like nobody doubts that this worked. You know, for, I mean, there's many, many examples like this. For me, like Longchenpa, you know, like I think of like the greatest philosopher of the tradition that I'm part of was Longchenpa. Like nobody doubts, but you know, his path, like, yes, he did all the study, but you know, at the end of the day, they went deeply into these traditions. So I think that's just for me, but I think that can help too, of just like, all right, I'm going to
Well,
take a leap here.
hold the faith because it works for Tsongkhapa.
Thank you. These are great questions. And yeah, it's a really wonderful question. Thank you for asking. Shannon.
Oh,
Hello,
I have
and
to
thank you
go.
for, excuse me, thank you for this talk. It was incredible. My question is about Buddha nature. When I'm thinking of it philosophically, it's my Buddha nature. I'm searching for my Buddha nature. But when I let go enough to have an experiential glimpse, it's spacious and it's not mine because there's no separation. I don't know if I'm making sense, but how do I get away, or do I work toward getting away from that my Buddha nature? That's what I'm looking for, versus just the Buddha nature for all that even beyond understand.
Great question. So here's the key point. You don't have to get away from anything. There is nothing to get away from. Like there's nothing that could possibly happen in your experience that you would ever need to get away from. Even the shift is where we're living, to use a kind of a more experiential term. So your mind can be completely dualistic and just the most strongly, I mean, forget about even what you're talking about, which is a very subtle, you know, kind of aspect of this, but imagine at your most neurotic, dualistic sense. And you can have a moment where, you know, something could happen and just suddenly you see that non-dual nature, but all of the seeming duality can still be happening. That's strong. But the difference is normally we're living in that space. Like that dualistic space consumes our entire conscious experience, right? So that's all that's going on. And so we think what needs to happen is, well, because that is like, we suffer when we're in that space. We want to get rid of that constricted thing, and we think this just needs to go away. And when that goes away, then we can experience that. But this constricted thing is not the problem. It's that we don't see it's that we don't see the nature of that. So once we see the nature of that, it's like we're the whole space, the universe of space within which that's happening. And that, you know, like what you're talking about, even like the seeming I-ness, that just becomes like a little weather pattern in like the open sky. But the shift has already happened. Like you've become the sky. You don't need to worry about the weather pattern anymore. It can still be the I, me weather pattern. That's fine. Like that's, you know, it's just like B was talking about. It can be like, you know, the Tsongkhapa weather pattern, talking about like the theories of emptiness. That's a weather pattern too, right? That's monkey mind talking about something. You know, it can be a beautiful dharmic monkey mind. It can be a completely neurotic monkey mind. The shift here is into the experience of literally learning to be the ocean, to be the sky, to be the space around it. And that's the beauty, is it doesn't ask us to get rid of anything, right? I mean, in a way you can say we've gotten rid of something, because what we've gotten rid of is the fixation part of it, right? It's like something clearly has changed. But I think that where we can sometimes get a misunderstanding is it's almost feeling like the surface experience of that has to go away too. So one way to look at this, it's weird terminology to use, but it's almost like there can be the actually B, you brought up Dzogchen Rinpoche. He talks about, he uses a something that I think is really skillful. He talks about like the mere eye, like the mere, like just like in Tibetan, there's this word tsum. It's like it's just like the, it's like the thing, but without the fixation. So you can have like mere duality almost, like even like the seeming me and you. But yet, if you recognize the nature of that, it's just like, you know, you're seeing the illusory quality of it as it's happening. But it doesn't need to stop happening, is the key thing. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you so
Yeah.
much.
Thank you, Janet. Great question. Ray.
The beautiful example that you gave at the beginning, talking about teachers who teach us something, connecting with the pointing out instruction. I believe that it comes not only from the technique that is given to us, or the instruction itself that comes to us by the teacher, but by may I name it, his own passion combined with his own fond experience. And the souvenir that came to my mind while you were talking was this teacher I had when I was a kid, who introduced me to folk music and folk dances. I have become a folk musician and a folk singer in my 20s because of that. And Jean-Guy would introduce me to Scottish music. I didn't know anything about Scotland. And he pointed me between two phrases. Listen to this. There will be a shift in tones and modes, and it will pass from minor to major, and it's a beautiful shift. Just pointing this, I was delighted by that music. So if I connect it to the pointing out instruction, I remember the first pointing out instruction I ever received. It was from my actual teacher, Chökyi Rinpoché. And the way he was bringing it, the experience that was beside his pointing out, I will always remember that because after he stopped teaching, I cried for about a half hour. Suddenly things, I mean, I have practiced Zen like you for about 8, 10 years. I came out of that, and all I had experienced on the cushion in the Zendo was alive suddenly more than ever. It's as if the Niagara Falls had stopped and I could see the stone behind for the first time. So I still believe that the instruction is important, but if we just wait for an instruction, there's the passion that we have to find also, and there's also this experience that comes behind the words. And of course, in a book, the passion and the experience is there. But can we catch it?
Yeah.
That's my question. It's easier to catch if we receive it directly. And when we have someone talking to us like you do, like Mingyur Rinpoche does to us, then this passion comes true.
Yeah. No, that's a great point and great stories, Ray. I think it, very true. I mean, I think having the, it's really all this kind of combination of factors, like the, you know, you could have the most amazing awakened teacher sitting in the room. And somebody come in who just doesn't have any interest, doesn't have any, you know, just could care less, and they're not going to get anything, right? So there's all the inner circumstances within us, you know, like with your
Sure,
folk music, like there clearly had to be something in you where you had the interest, you had the willingness to seek it out, you had the openness and some interest, and you had some respect for the person, you know, for your teacher, like all of these things within you. And then you had, you know, the teacher's passion, their experience, their knowledge, all of that. And somehow there's this magical alchemy that can happen like in that space.
sure.
And I think there's certainly something very powerful when it's like the direct person to person side of that. I must say though, like I've had very powerful experiences with books, you know, and I think that they're, you know, when the heart is open and you have the devotion. You know, for me, like I talk about Lungchenpa all the time. Like I, you know, I just I could look at a book and like I don't know what it was, even not even reading it, like literally just open like the Tibetan text and just sit there with it. And there was something going on. I can't explain it at all. Like I don't want to say there's some mystical power or whatever. I mean, honestly, I can't explain it, other than I just know that there
So,
was something that was just something going on that was really powerful for
I
me.
have to make an appointment with Dr. Janet.
There's, Hey, Shelly, I think you're unmuted. I think we're hearing your conversation right now.
Oh, sorry
Doctor
about
is the Buddha.
Buddha. I hope the
The
doctor's
doctor is
appointment goes well.
the Buddha.
So in any case, so I think it can happen in many ways, but there's no question that like the real, like that heart to heart. And there's a few questions. I realize we're over time here, so I'll try to get to these written questions quickly and then we'll wrap it up here. But Irina asked about is it crucial to have a teacher with whom a student has a personal relationship, not let's say a teacher on a course, et cetera. No, actually, I would say I think it's possible, to have to have that kind of relationship. And I would say, in a way, maybe the most important relationship is through, retreats and courses and things like that. It's definitely not like you have to meet one-on-one, and have this kind of very personal relationship. And there again, there's many stories from the tradition of examples. There's certainly many stories where a teacher, like Milarepa and Marpa, where you have this very intimate personal relationship. But there's plenty of other ones where it was like just a very fleeting passing story, or where a teacher was just in a huge group of people and receiving teaching. So there's, at the end of the day, if the heart of the student is open and they're receptive and passionate and interested and have some respect and devotion or faith or whatever you want to call it, and the teacher, and there's an experienced, realized teacher, that can, that the nature of that can, connection can happen in many, many different ways. It can happen via Zoom. I mean, I have zero doubt that somebody could get enlightened by getting teachings via Zoom and practicing deeply. I have no doubt personally that you could travel the whole path that way, personally. So I think everything beyond that is just circumstance, and we all have different karma and circumstances and what works and what doesn't. I can say for my student, from my own personal experience, I've spent a lot of time with Mingyur Rinpoche and even with some other teachers as well, like tons of time. And you might look at that and be like, oh, wow, Court has amazing karma. He knows Mingyur Rinpoche personally. And, I don't say this to brag, but because of just the work I do, I can just send him a message on WhatsApp and he will answer, usually in a few days. And you might think, whoa, Court has this amazing, like his, like in a sense, of course, I have this relationship with Rinpoche. The most important from being a Dharma practitioner, what I really have received from Rinpoche is being in the retreats, of being sitting in Zoom. Like that's like what is helpful for me in practice. It's not the fact that I have can and do communicate with him in that way. It's that I've been in these retreats with him. It's that I've sat there. It's that I can, like all of you can, I can put a question in the chat that he can respond to and that he's giving point. That's for me where I have received the real spiritual benefit from my relationship with him. So but it's just easy to look at that and be like, oh, you kind of need that close personal relationship. I really don't think you do, honestly. In some ways, it can almost create an issue because you have this very human relationship where you're just, I mean, I have to talk to Rinpoche about organizational stuff. It like he's great in that respect, but it stops being this just pure dharmic relationship in a way too. So in any case, that's just maybe it should be a commercial for Zoom or something. I don't know, but I definitely don't think you need this like really, really personal thing, that we oftentimes think we do. So there's a whole bunch more questions. I don't think I'm going to be able to get to all of them, but let me try to do a speed round with a few. Can we continue with the immersion course without pointing out instructions as an observer? Not necessarily a practitioner. For instance, is it okay for me to attend my discussion group meetings when they move on to the immersion part? So for this one, I think that so the immersion course will have some requirements. It really is for people who have received pointing out instructions. And we've all, I mean, I certainly have, and I think many of us have all been in the place where we haven't yet received those instructions. And there's things where it kind of feels like the door is closed. I think unfortunately for the immersion course, we do need to honor those requirements because that's the requirements that Rinpoche himself has set. And there's a very important reason for that, which is simply that until we receive pointing out instructions, getting all the teachings, it basically creates a lot of, basically we get all the concepts, and it ultimately can doesn't help and can even hinder our practice when we just have so many ideas about the teachings. And then when we actually get pointing out instructions, it can just, it just basically, we're kind of like wading through a lot of conceptual thinking about it. So I would say if you're interested in going further, the most, probably the best thing to do is, you know, there's going to be a Nectar of the Path course or other things like really the, to basically that's going to help create the conditions for when you receive pointing out instructions. And I would definitely recommend trying to do what you can to receive pointing out instructions because they're so powerful. But until that point, I think the there's other courses probably that will be better, more supportive of the process. So let's see, how long does it usually take to stay fluently in touch with our Buddha nature with the Mahamudra approach? That's an interesting question. You know, I think it, in a way you could say it's a lot like learning a language. It's really how immersed we are. It can be as slow or as fast as, you know, we want it to be. Obviously, long-term retreat is meant to be that kind of deep immersion where obviously it speeds up the practice. If that's all we're doing 24 hours a day is just working on that, it'll go faster. On the other hand, if we don't do much daily practice and we don't have, you know, we don't have a community, we don't have, you know, we're not kind of surrounding ourselves with conditions to support that, then it's, we're still on the path and it's like kind of we have the virus is sort of in our system, so to speak. Sorry, that's a bad analogy. Every time I use that, I'm like, that's a terrible analogy to use in the age of COVID, but you probably get the idea. But it's always going to be there, but the process will obviously be slower. So I think a lot of a lot of the path is simply creating the conditions for practice. So the more, like this is where community can be a huge help. This is basically why we created these courses and immersion programs, you know, so you can basically have a lot of things on a daily basis that are just kind of creating inner circumstances that will help facilitate that. So again, it really depends on your inner, your individual circumstances, but these are things that, you know, we definitely can help. You know, we can do things in our lives that will help support that process. So there's another question. I'm almost done with Joy of Living Level 3. Is there any way I can get pointing out instructions before the immersion course begins? I could travel to meet a Tergar approved teacher if there is such a process. It's really just the events that Rinpoche offers, or other teachers potentially, like Tsokni Rinpoche, who B mentioned is an amazing, wonderful teacher. Ray mentioned Chökyänima Rinpoche, another amazing teacher. So there's other teachers also giving pointing out instructions. So I would, you know, you can sign up for Vajrayana online and set up a practice interview. I think, you know, any of the instructors or Kunsang could help, probably help you figure that out. But it would be necessary to basically attend an event somewhere where you would be getting pointing out instructions. And I think just to meet whatever the requirements are for the course. Lindsay also asked, so Lindsay, you're probably hearing here, but there are prerequisites for the immersion course, not for the Nectar of the Path course that will be open. And there's of course many other courses that are in Vajrayana online that you can take as well. But the Ganges Mahamudra course does have prerequisites. And I think that's it. I think we got through all the questions. So apologies for going over, which I tend to do. But why don't we just take a moment to dedicate the merit, or if you're unfamiliar with that, just imagine that whatever good has come from this time together, that we send that out into the world so that all beings everywhere might recognize their own Buddha nature. And if you want to put your screen on gallery view, I have a little ritual of having every, if you want to unmute yourself, we can all just say hello and goodbye to each other. I love seeing all your faces on the.
Goodbye.
Goodbye,
Goodbye.
everyone. Thank you,
Bye,
Gord.
everyone.
Bye.
Cool. So,
Bye.
obrigada. Thank
Really,
you.
really great.
You all.
Thank you. Thank
Thank
you.
Adios.
Bye.
Bye bye.
Thank you.
You all
Bye.
take care. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Bye
Thank
bye.
you.